Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Face and Condition. I'm your host, Thunashree, and today I'm talking to Naveed Stone. I know your name is not actually Naveed Stone.
No, it's not.
Is that like your stage name that you
It's kind of a stage name that started from an inside joke. We can talk a little bit more about that later. But my real last name is Ahmed.
Okay.
So Naveed Ahmed in the building. What's up?
Naveed is a badass Bangladeshi rock star from right here in Queens, New York, and he's here today. We're talking about representation and what it's like to make music in a predominantly white space, as well as breaking the mold of desi and Asian expectations, and just the anxieties and uncertainties surrounding a creative pursuit and throwing yourself fully into a creative pursuit. Hi, Naveed.
Hi. Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me. This is a dope platform that I think, you know, I can really divulge on things that I really don't get to talk much about anywhere else, so I'm happy to be here.
That's awesome. I'm so excited that you're here. I have been following you guys for a while. Recently, I saw that you posted a cover of Circles by Post Malone, which, by the way, thank you for introducing me to Post Malone. I did not know what I was missing.
Hey, that's cool.
I like love it. He's so interesting. He's like so diverse. Also, dude, you have range. Like, did you grow up singing?
So yeah, well, first of all, thank you for the cover. Yeah, no, on our Instagram page for the band In Loving Memory, you can find us on Instagram on In Loving Memory NY. Lately we've just kind of been throwing up like quick, you know, minute long covers of songs that we're digging as far as like mainstream artists go, just to keep ourselves active. But as far as like me getting into singing, it's funny because from a very young age, like when I was like a toddler, like my parents would tell me like I would always be just like belting along to songs in the car. But then kind of like around the age where I started school, I started getting like super shy. So I would just like, it's funny, like I went from being such a hyperactive like toddler to like a really shy kid once I hit that age of like 5 or 6. But I kind of got back into music like around the age of 12 or so, because when I was in sixth grade, that song Hey There Delilah by the Plain White Tees came out, and that song was like, to this day, that's my favorite song of all time. And I heard that song and I'm like, whoa, like one guy and his guitar could make something like that beautiful. Like, well, I want to see what that's about. So I started picking up guitar from there, and kind of in middle school, that's when I started finding like similar bands like Plain White Tees, All Time Low, Boys Like Girls, like those kind of bands. And that's when I really started like honing like my, you know, my love for singing, playing guitar, and then eventually like writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
On the specific topic of range, it's funny how things work, because around that age, I started like getting left home alone more often, because by that time, both my parents were working. So I kind of had the freedom of just like, you know, being able to be at home by myself and just belt. Like, and that's when my range started getting more powerful. Like, I remember struggling to sing certain songs back then that I can like plow through now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny that even as my voice got old, you know, as I got older and my voice changed, my range still got higher because of that raw, you know,
mm-hmm.
just sitting in your room practicing all day.
Yeah, hell yeah. Practicing all day, that's how you do it. So you are in a band called In Loving Memory, in which you are the lead singer, also guitarist. Is that, have I covered all of your
well, I think we're an interesting case now, because the band is just two of us, myself and my drummer / producer / multi-instrumentalist / my favorite white boy, Tom, I love you. Yeah, no, between the two of us, we write and record all the instruments, mostly Tom, because he is just a kick-ass musician at every instrument he touches. Seriously, the kid is insane. But yeah, no, we've always been the creative core of the band. We, you know, we're fully independent, so all the business that goes on in the band also happens between the two of us. Like I said, he produces all our music as well. He went to school for audio production.
Oh, okay, cool.
So,
wow,
yeah.
That's very useful for you.
Oh, definitely. No, me and him are a great team, because we cover each other's checks and balances a lot. Like I've taken on more of the role of being like the songwriter in the band, whereas he's a much better producer. So he's great at executing my visions and bringing them to life.
Mm-hmm.
So we make a good team in that regard.
Mm-hmm. How did you guys start the band?
So In Loving Memory actually kind of started as my solo project back when I was in like yeah, like junior, senior year of high school, I was kind of like recording songs that I had written on my own with just like local friends of mine who were producers. And I was kind of just putting them out on YouTube and just doing YouTube covers on my channel of just like songs that I was enjoying. I mean, I've taken a lot of them down now because nobody needs to see, you know, how cringy I was when I was 16, 17. Ain't nobody need to see that. But the guys who ended up joining In Loving Memory with me and starting it, they found me straight up through that YouTube channel. So it's, you know, that I think that's testament to just the power of the internet. Like, we didn't meet through, you know, mutual friends or anything like that. We didn't even meet through like the music scene. It was straight up through the internet. But,
oh,
you know,
really cool.
It just so happens that, yeah, you know, they lived in Long Island in Levittown. So, you know, about 40 minutes or so from me. And that's how we got connected. Yeah.
Cool. You've been doing this for a few years?
Yeah. So In Loving Memory as a band has been going for about 5 years now.
That's great. This, I assume, wasn't your parents' plan for you. Was this your plan for you?
No and no. Definitely. It's funny because when I was like younger, I wasn't always, like, I'm definitely not that story of, like, when you hear someone, like, oh, yeah, they've been performing since they were three.
Mm-hmm.
We took them to see concerts when they were, like, four, and he knew that this was what he was going to do for the rest of his life. I'm definitely not that story.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, like, as a really young kid, I was kind of, like, I didn't really keep up with music. Like, I remember kind of feeling left out in conversations and, like, elementary school when like kids would be talking about like, I don't know, like the new like gym class hero song or, you know what I mean, like whoever was big at the time. And I remember like feeling left out. But like I said, it was like around sixth grade when that song Hey There Delilah came out and really like kind of intrigued me. And then I started finding bands from there. So it could be attributed to that cliche of like, I didn't choose music, like music chose me.
Oh, I love that.
So
okay.
Yeah, that's how that started. But, you know, it's funny because the plan was always, you know, for my parents and for myself, you know, grow up, you know, like I feel like every Desi kid, like at the age of like five or something, your parents come at you and they're like, all right, boy, like engineer, doctor, lawyer, pharmacist, pick one. And I'm just like, wait, what? I'm only five. Wait, what?
Yep.
That's basically how it is. So I chose engineering because, you know, I mean, I was always math and science oriented. And that's what I ended up getting my degree in at Stony Brook. And, you know, that's what I work as full-time at the moment. So I explain to a lot of people, like, it kind of feels like I'm living, like, a double life, that Hannah Montana life, you know, like, engineer by day, trying to be a rock star by night. So that's very much the life that I've been living for, I mean, I guess the past decade or so, whether, like, you know, because for as long as I can remember now, like, whether I was in high school, you know, just banging away at the guitar in my spare time compared to then going to college, you know, starting In Loving Memory while I was in college, balancing my academics with, you know, starting to play shows, starting to tour, like starting to get a dip into that lifestyle. And now it just evolved into, you know, me working full time and then just trying to build a band concurrently along with that. So that whole double life has always been prevalent for me for, you know, as long as I can remember now.
Mm-hmm. Recently, you started talking about the double life in your release of Slave. Why did you... Well, first, tell... This is a two-parter. First, tell us a little more about what Slave is about. And then, two, why did you choose now?
Cool. So, yeah, Slave is a cool song. It's off of our newest EP, Diamonds Under Pressure, that came out in September. And Slave is the last track off that record, but it was the first one that we wrote for the record. So lyrically, it follows an interesting format where, like, each verse in the song is kind of me talking about how, you know, wanting to be a musician and wanting to, you know, really just be a slave to it, because that's what the title encapsulates. It really talks about the sacrifices that come with that and how those sacrifices can impact different relationships in my life. So the first verse talks about, like, basically my fear of, like, you know, wanting to be a touring musician and not being able to find, like, a girlfriend and eventually a wife that can support that lifestyle. And, you know, because it takes a lot. It takes two very special people to basically, at that point, it's a long distance relationship when you're touring full time and you're gone, you know, months and months out of the year. So that part of the song talks about that fear. The second verse talks about basically how I feel like I've lost friends because of it, which is sort of frustrating because, you know, a lot of friends who, you know, they say they support you and they say they want to see you rise to the top, yet they can't understand when you have to, you know, when you can't hang out on Friday and mm-hmm. Saturday night because you really have to grind and you really have to be playing shows. Like, especially when, you know, in my position, when you're in college, like, you don't have time to party on the weekends because I kind of had to, I had to get all my work done on the weekdays because almost every weekend I was with the band, whether we were practicing or whether we were recording videos or playing shows. Like, it felt like I was playing the college game on hard mode in that sense. And then finally in the third verse, you know, it really opens up about, you know, how music affects my relationship with my parents, where, you know, obviously, you know, I give them so much credit because they've never stopped me from doing anything. And I have a lot of gratitude because I realize, like, they've let me get away with some wild stuff that I know a lot of Desi parents wouldn't. Like,
what's that?
The biggest example I can really remember of, like, us really going at it as far as, like, clashing wits was about in the middle of my junior year of college, of undergrad. That was when, in loving memory, we went on our first tour. And it was a 3-week tour.
In the middle of college, you said?
Yeah, okay. In the middle of junior year.
Okay.
So we were going on a 3-week tour, and that was basically a Midwest tour. It started, like, around, like, Ohio, Michigan, went down to, like, Georgia, and then came back up. But this tour was scheduled to be in April. So, like, basically, like,
right before finals.
Yeah, like, right before finals.
Ooh.
So I planned it out, you know, the best that I could. We knew about the tour since, like, December of, you know, prior, so a few months prior. And as soon as I locked it down, like, as soon as the band locked it down, I was like, okay, I need to figure out how this is going to work, like, school-wise. So I sent emails to all my professors that I was going to have that semester, because right now it was winter break. And I was basically just like, hey, what's up? I'm going to have you next semester. Just letting you know, I'm in a quote-unquote touring musical group, because I guess that's more legitimate. Like, that sounds more legitimate than saying, yeah, I'm in a band. So, okay. And I'm like, we're going to be going on tour, and I'm going to be unavailable from this date to this date. You know, what can I do to, you know, make up work and exams? And basically all of them were just like, cool. We'll talk about that when the semester starts. Basically, they're just like, we'll figure it out. But it ended up working out fine in that regard. Like, I definitely did have to submit assignments on the road, so there was definitely a lot of me.
You were, like, studying on the road,
yep,
too.
I was basically a student on the road, like, playing shows at night. So I definitely have vivid memories of me being cooped up in the back of the van on my laptop, on my, you know, iPhone hotspot to, like, download stuff off Blackboard and stuff
that.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully, like, shout out to my friends who were in my classes because they always sent me notes. Like, they made sure I was in the loop while I wasn't physically present for classes. But, you know, I still had to submit assignments. And then basically I had 2 finals weeks because when I got back from the tour, I had to make up, like, 3 or 4 exams. And then the week after that was actual finals week. So it was definitely, honestly, now that I'm talking about it, I'm like, wow, I really did that.
Awesome, though. That's what you gotta do.
Yeah, like, it's funny because when eventually I had to explain to my parents that, yes, I'm going to be on tour. And then, like, how do you explain that to Desi parents? What does that even mean? Like, you have to explain, like, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to be, like, living in the van. Oh, yeah, we're going to be, like, sleeping in there most nights, too.
Yeah,
like,
that's how
I
wanted you to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Their main fear, and I had to, there were a lot of intense conversations where eventually I made them understand, like, they were like, are you being dumb? Like, are you dropping out of school? Like, what the hell are you doing? I'm just like, and that got me so heated because I'm like, wow, like, here I am, like, working. Like, I planned this so meticulously so that I would not have to sacrifice my academics at all. And here they are, like, not even willing to hear me out about this. But eventually they came around, and eventually I realized, like, okay, like, you can explain things all you want, but eventually you just have to show them what your intentions are, and you have to kind of show them with the results.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I kind of delivered the results. Like, we had a good first tour, you know, relatively successful. I actually did pretty well that semester, all things considered. And I was a kick-ass boyfriend in that time, too. So, you know what? I had all bases covered. I was proud of that for sure.
This is a Renaissance man.
Damn straight. That experience definitely showed, like, at that point, that was, like, the culmination of, like, okay, Naveed, how well can you really manage this double life?
Okay.
So for me, that was like a good test to really like.
Well, you're still living a double life.
Oh yeah, no, I've definitely like.
Yes, let's talk about that.
Yeah,
that. For a sec.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
You're working full time as
right.
an engineer.
At the moment, I'm in between jobs, but
okay.
I'm gonna be back on the 9-to-5 life pretty soon. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So I have a question for you. How are your parents now? How do they feel about your double life?
So the way I see it is like, as long as I'm working full time, like they're pretty comfortable. Like they, you know, whatever I do in my free time outside of that, like they don't really need to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
They still see, you know, every weekend I'm working on music, I'm doing something, and they see that as soon as I come home every day, like I'm locking myself in my room, you know, grinding away, singing, practicing, you know, doing whatever. So lately it's been relatively like fine. You know,
mm-hmm.
The main thing that I try to adhere to is that, you know, since the day I finished school, like I try to, you know, give them money every month, especially since I'm still living with them.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I've taken some breaks as far as like being unemployed, I've always made sure to like save up enough money so that I can still, you know, keep that going with them. So
yeah,
because
you're
obviously
good. You're financially secure at least.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. No, and I, you know,
that's what really counts to them. I feel
totally,
like.
Totally,
really,
and that honestly I wouldn't be in that position if I didn't, you know, finish school and get my degree.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, to anybody else who's, you know, who's still in their double life, I would say like. Basically, you know, you can finish college and still be only 21. Like,
mm-hmm.
and that's still super young. You still have so much time ahead of you. So I don't see too much reason to close that door on yourself, to close the door of having, you know, a degree or at least some kind of stable education to fall back on. And the way I see it for me is since I did finish school, I kind of feel a little more fearless in chasing music all the way because, you know, shit can hit the fan,
mm-hmm.
and I can still be all right.
Yeah, you have a really good fallback option.
Absolutely. So
yeah.
I would recommend, you know, I also respect the idea of just, you know, not giving yourself a plan B. Like sometimes, because sometimes that's how people, you know, really perform at their best is when they can't afford to fail.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, that's just the life plan that made most sense to me. And also, you know, will definitely create a lot less problems in the long run as far as like my relationship with my parents, because obviously that's something I want to always preserve. I don't want to damage that.
So is engineering like something that you hope to keep doing for a while, or are you hoping for music to be your primary source?
I would love to be that person that's like, you know, I would love to be a full-time musician and live that touring lifestyle. But I also would feel incomplete if I never got my master's at some point. You know what I mean? Like I can tell that that's not even my parents talking. That's just, you know,
that's just
my
you.
Values as a person. So I'm glad I still, like, I genuinely value education to that extent. And I know that's not our culture talking. I know that's not my parents talking because no one's telling me to do that. But I just know that I wouldn't feel fulfilled if I never did that. Plus, I think that's a good example to people. Like I very much like admire celebrities and musicians who, you know them for one thing, whether it's like music or acting or whatever, but then you're like, what? They're a doctor? Like, wait, what? Like,
yeah.
I just think that's so cool.
Yeah.
So I would love to be someone who's just really multifaceted like that.
I love that. Yeah, why not? What I notice about the track Slave is that you don't fall into like this entrapment of, I feel like a lot of people in our disposition, our generation are like blaming their parents for like, oh my god, like I was listening to my parents and I ended up doing this and that and I didn't want to do it and now I don't know who I am or what I want to do. I'd like that you don't fall into the trap of blaming your immigrant parents for all your problems and just acknowledging that they just love you and they just want the best for you and that music wasn't necessarily the route that they imagined, but it's just, you know, who you are and what you need to do.
Totally. I think the most important thing for people in that position where they do feel resentment to their culture or their families or whatever the case, or whatever combination of the two it may be, is just like realizing like our parents are on our side. Like they,
mm-hmm.
they do want us to be healthy, happy, you know, stable financially. Like obviously like you know, if we have immigrant parents, like, we need to, I think we should exercise a little bit of empathy to the fact that, like, yo, like, they gave up their lives, a lot of them, to come here, left everything that they know behind just so we could have a chance to grow up in this country, you know, full of way more opportunity. So I'm all, you know, so much of my gratitude and honestly, like, my purpose comes from that. Like, as especially, you know, being an artist in this time where, you know, the immigrant story, there's so much hostility towards people like us. I think it's more important than ever that, you know, there are artists talking about that story and really bringing it to the Western audience. So as far as, like, you know, to go back and answer the question of, like, why now? Like, why am I singing about these things now? Because I've always talked, you know, I always talk about and post about these things, but now I really feel that urgency and the confidence to really put that in the music.
Yeah. I think you make a good point too. It's really important to be empathetic of what they've been through, empathetic of it, understanding, not guilt. I think sometimes we're either blaming our parents for problems or we feel guilty about everything that they went through.
Right.
And it's just kind of, we just exist on two sides of the spectrum and not in, like, this healthy place, which is where you're at, which is, like, it's just a good balance.
Right. And, you know, it's a balance that I struggle with every day also. Mm-hmm. Like, now that you bring up guilt, yeah, there often comes that position where I'm like, oh my God, like, they really, especially when I've seen them struggle throughout the years just to keep a roof over my head, I'm like, damn, like, they're working so hard for me and I'm really just out here trying to be a musician. Like, and you know, that sparks all the conversations I have with myself. I'm like, am I a bad son to them? Like, am I, you know, how dare I have the audacity to do these things when they literally gave up their lives just so I could have a chance.
And we're sitting here with the luxury of hobbies and dreams.
Right. No, I'm glad you bring that up because that's another thing that keeps me so, you know, ultimately grateful for the position that we are in, is that we recognize these things are privileges. Like, the fact that we're able to pursue lives of fulfillment and happiness, like, that in itself is a privilege, because there are so many people in the world, especially, you know, our parents and their generation, they're not living life to be happy necessarily. They're just trying to survive.
Yeah.
They're just really trying to, you know, make sure that they and their future generations are going to be provided for. Like, they don't have time to worry about, like, oh, like, I'm what's fulfilling to me. Like, they don't have the privilege, the luxury to worry about those things. So it's funny to me because I see so many people who, like, they act very entitled to success, and I'm just out here, like, I just consider myself privileged to be even able to play the game of happiness.
That's so true.
That's how I view it.
Yeah. So the reason I wanted to interview you specifically is because I think that many first generationers end up getting into, like, the rap and hip hop game. You did not. You were more into, like, rock, alternative rock, maybe even, like, heavy metal.
Yeah,
rock.
Totally.
Which is hilarious because I was too. So then when I started talking to you and I was like, oh my God, this guy speaks my language. Like,
right.
Because I don't know a lot of brown people that listen to, like, hard rock music.
Neither do I, trust
me. Yeah, I was definitely, like, one of the only ones growing up. But anyways, I think, like, a lot of first generationers or children of immigrants tend to vibe more with rap and hip hop, which to me makes a lot of sense because it's also generally produced by people of color. So there's, like, you know, some likeness.
Absolutely.
There.
No, I totally understand because we, as young brown kids, we're looking for people that we can relate to. And obviously, you know, unfortunately in Western culture, we don't have many role models that look like us just yet. So I think that's why, especially growing up in New York City, I noticed a lot of us brown kids, Hispanic kids included, we tend to resonate more with black culture because that's where we see, like, oh, these are people of color kicking ass and honestly ruling the world in regards to culture. So I feel like that's why a lot of us kids end up gravitating towards that. And it's funny because while I grew up resonating more with, like, rock music and then even metal, I'm definitely, like, appreciating, you know, hip hop and rap culture a lot more nowadays. And that, you know, that's also finding influence in our newer music. Like, I even rap on a couple songs here and there, but obviously, you know, the road to being a musician has opened my mind and in just appreciating all forms of not just music and entertainment, but just also business, the way people go about building their brands and representing their cultures.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little more in a minute. Mm-hmm. First, I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about what it was like growing up. I can speak from my own personal experience as people being confused as to why I was so supportive of, like, this angry white boy music, mm-hmm. and now that you're producing, quote-unquote, angry white boy music.
Yep, that's exactly the phrase.
Yeah. So, like, what was that?
It was around high school when I really started, like, making music for the first time. That's when I also started getting into, like, metal, like, heavier stuff. Like, I was literally, like, my older music has, like, screamo in it, like, strict, like, and so it's funny because it was at that stage where I realized, like, I kind of didn't fit in regardless of who I was hanging out with. Like, all my fellow Bengali kids would be like, yo, Naveed, why are you making that white boy music? Like, what's good with you? Like, they would kind of, like, even though they were my friends, they would kind of, like, endearingly mock, like, the screamo stuff. Like, they would just, like, yell when we were just, like, outside, like, oh, that's the music you make, right? And then they meant it well. You know, they didn't mean, they didn't mean to offend by it, but obviously.
Why? Because it's just so familiar to me.
And I would laugh along with it, but I'm also like, okay, like, they definitely don't fully understand me. But, you know, in Stuyvesant High School, where I went to for high school, the main group of kids, you know, making music and, like, being in bands were, like, you know, like, hipster kids from Park Slope, Brooklyn. So, obviously, I didn't relate too much to them either.
Yeah.
So, I was kind of just always doing my own thing in that regard. But, I don't know, it's just funny to me how, like, in my musical journey, like, I can probably count on one hand the amount of, you know, they see musicians in rock or metal. Like,
yeah.
Like, I literally can't
remember. I know so few. I don't think I can even name anyone other than you off the top of my head. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, to me, it's crazy to me, but it's also not, because, again, like we were just saying, like, it just seems to be the case that, you know, kids from our demographic tend to resonate more with rap and hip hop culture, which I think it's definitely been a motivator as to why in recent years I've kind of fallen away from rock music, because now that I'm valuing more of what type of message I want to put out there and who I want that message to resonate with, I've just naturally fallen more into pop music, hip hop music.
Okay.
Like, I look more to what the mainstream is doing, because at the end of the day, you know, the mainstream has such a negative connotation depending on who you talk to, but at the end of the day, like, these are the artists and people who are shaping the culture, you know, on a worldwide scale.
Mm-hmm.
So
I have a question for you. Did you feel like this sense of, like, not belonging that you're talking about, did you feel like that was ever discouraging at some point for you to, like, or discouraged you from pursuing a life in music?
Definitely was, because, you know, with all the metal bands and the rock bands that I was loving, like, at the time, like, musically, you know, literally all I do in my spare time is, like, watch interviews of artists, and, like, most of them, the story is basically, oh yeah, my dad was in a band, he took me to see Billy Joel when I was 5, and I was like, wow, that's what I want to do with my life. And I'm just like, wow, so it was, like, that easy for you. Like, you know, like, you hear
this very straightforward.
Very straightforward, yeah. And at the end of the day, like, because there was nobody that represented me or represented, you know, a story like ours in that realm of music, it was definitely discouraging, because there were so many times where I thought, like, damn, like, is it even possible for a kid like me to make it if I don't have that kind of support from day one? Or even on a more superficial level, like, you see what artists are making it, and, you know, like, when you hear the word rock star, like, what do you imagine in your head? You imagine a pretty white boy with long hair, tattoos, piercings. You definitely don't imagine someone like me. So that, you know, that led to, you know, some insecurities with my image. Like, I felt like I had to dress a certain way, and I should say, like, I've never, in my journey as a musician and with the people I've encountered, I've definitely never experienced, like, explicit, like, racism. I mean, other than the occasional, like, YouTube comment or whatever.
Okay.
But I definitely feel from people, like, you feel in the way they talk to you, you know, like the, what's the word, like microaggressions.
Oh, yes,
you kind of feel that people don't take you as seriously as an aspiring musician because you don't look like you fit in the culture, like just because I'm not tatted up and all that stuff. So that's another thing about the, at least the rock scene that kind of turned me off.
Okay.
Because I'm like, okay, like these people are not taking me seriously, but at the end of the day, I know I can outsing you and write a better quality song than you any day of the week.
Hell yeah.
So.
Yeah. That. I can, I mean, look at the way that I'm wearing a dress with flowers on it, and I remember, like, talking about, I was listening to, like, you know, all the stuff that other kids were listening to when I was, like, middle school, high school, like, just pop music. I'd be like, yeah, Britney Spears, and then I'd be like, yeah, Drowning Pool, you know, like, I was, like, stained.
Right.
And so I remember, like, people not really believing that I like these bands, and I don't know why they would think that in order for me to appear as cool, I would start naming these bands that, like, nobody, like, not that many other people were listening to. So first of all, if I was trying to be cool, that's not what I would have said.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, my point is that, like, people not really taking me seriously because I don't look a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And so I remember, like, getting quizzed by people about, like, absurd things that nobody knows about bands, but, like, I should know because I
If you're claiming to be a fan of them, you got to know, you got to know what's the name of the guitarist's ex-girlfriend, or, like, dumb shit. No, that's interesting that, like, not even trying to be a musician, you still
feel... I wasn't trying to be a musician,
Just to even be a fan, you felt that that exclusivity, that other, that otherness.
That's interesting. It was weird. We're going to take a short break, and after this break, we'll talk about In Loving Memory's creative process and inspiration, as well as the new genre that they're exploring called Urban Alternative, how that shift came about, and just generally the challenges that Naveen and Tom face being in a band. So stick around, and we'll be back in a second.
Yeah, the homies on the block don't fuck with me no more. They be thinking I still got the time, and I can drink and smoke. Think this music shit's a game, but it ain't no joke. Try to put us brown kids on the map, cause ain't nobody know what it's like to grow up insecure, cause everybody making waves don't look like you. So I say it's impossible for a kid like us to make it through. A change is due, and I wanna be the star, so I gotta fight twice as hard. I'm a slave to the music that's in my veins. I'm gonna chase it till I go insane. Even then, don't think I'll break away. The love for the game, I'm gonna feel like a slave.
So you've been exploring other genres outside of rock, and you have now, I guess, defined your music as urban alternative.
Right.
Tell us about that.
So the past, like, 2018 and 2019, like, recording the EP that would become Diamonds Under Pressure, we really started from square one, because prior to that, our music was basically, like, what we would call, like, post-hardcore, like, mostly singing, but, you know, had a lot of, like, heavier elements, you know, a lot of distorted guitar riffs, loud drums, breakdowns, occasional screams and all that. But we really started from square one, and it started with the question of, like, you know, what message am I ultimately trying to put out there, and how can I package it to, you know, ideally a worldwide audience? Because we realized we don't want to just be musicians that cater to a certain niche. We want to be able to, you know, make music that changes the world and can really affect everybody, regardless of what demographic they come from. I feel like any musician or any artist should aspire to that level of grandeur. So we kind of just pulled from all our influences, and the sound we came, you know, we, as we started writing and recording more songs, the sound that we ended up settling with was like, okay, like, I'm noticing my lyrics are a lot more raw and a lot more personal than they've ever been. And that, I attribute that to a lot of, like, the hip-hop artists I was getting into, or at least pop artists that were incorporating elements of hip-hop. So, like John Bellion was a huge influence on me in that time. Rappers like Lil TJ, Rich Brian, and Rich Brian especially, because I'm like, okay, this is a kid from Indonesia taking over the world, you know what I mean? Like, and here I am worried, like, oh, how am I, as a Bengali kid from New York, how am I going to package my story in a way that people of all can understand it? And then I'm like, okay, here's this kid literally from the other side of the world, didn't even have formal schooling, English is a second language, and boom, he comes to America and he can pack out 3,000 cat venues and you look at the crowds and it's not just other Asian kids, it's kids of all kinds. So when I saw him perform and I saw what his crowd looked like, I'm like, okay, that's goals for sure. So we, you know, obviously we come from the background of playing in bands, like emphasizing organic instruments, like emphasizing, you know, our dedication to that. And we wanted to maintain that. But at the same time, we wanted to, you know, create, we wanted to explore, you know, more sonic elements as far as producing. So we have songs now, like Slave, for example, that don't even have drums, guitars, bass. You know, it's a lot more pop, hip-hop, electronic. And so that definitely pushed Tom as a producer. He had to experiment a lot. But then we also have songs on the record that are very much true to you know, the band background that we come from. So Urban Alternative kind of comes from, like, I guess that hybrid of, like, wanting to combine the raw authenticity of hip-hop culture with the organic musicianship that comes from, you know, our background as being in bands. Because one thing that I see in a lot of rap culture is, like, they get a lot of heat for, you know, quote-unquote, not being actual musicians, like, because especially when you see a lot of rappers, like, they just go on stage and they just sing over, like, their backtracks, like, it seems a little lazy to me sometimes, but, you know, I see a lot nowadays where, you know, rappers and pop artists of all kinds, they're doing live shows with live bands. I think people as a whole are starting to value, like, organic instruments again, like, pop radio is definitely more diverse than it's ever been. It's not just, like, you know, generic dance electronic beats. So I think we want to bring we basically want to make instruments cool again, but also accessible to everybody.
Make instruments great again, sorry.
No, facts. That's a fact. And since you brought up Post Malone, like, I think he's a great artist, like, at the forefront of that. Like, you can watch him at the VMAs shredding guitar solos and straight up singing, but he's also a rapper at the end of the day. So I think artists like him are really leading that charge. And so Urban Alternative is, like, kind of our take on that and us wanting to, you know, be part of that side of culture.
I have a question for you.
Talk to me.
You have fans who have tattoos of In Loving Memory's logo. So this is a two-part question. Mm-hmm. One, how the hell? Two, how did you, I guess, go about gaining such a large presence, kind of like almost like a cult following behind In Loving Memory that people are, like, getting tatted up, especially as, you know, as we've been talking about, as someone who doesn't have the typical image of a musician?
So, I mean, yeah, that's a very dense question. I mean, first of all, I still think it's dope that people are getting In Loving Memory tattoos. A fan sent us one this week, and I'm just like, wow. This is still crazy.
Yeah,
like,
that's so cool.
I don't even love In Loving Memory enough to get a tattoo of it, you know what I mean? I actually don't have any tattoos, but... as far as, like, you know, how we've built our following so far, honestly, I think it's better to answer, like, how haven't we? Like, we've tried absolutely anything and everything. Like, since day one, I mean, we started off making a lot of YouTube covers, which, you know, I was always a big believer in, because, I mean, hey, like, my channel when I was, like, 17 or 18 wasn't even that big at all. I had, like, 2,000 subscribers, which is, you know, nothing in the grand scheme. Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know, my bandmates actually found me. So, obviously, I was like, okay, YouTube has potential. So you know, the fact that we have a producer in the band and someone who knows how to video edit makes it very possible for us to crank out content, you know, pretty quickly. So whenever popular songs whenever popular songs would drop from bands that we liked, we would be like, all right, drop everything we're doing. We gotta learn this song. We gotta cover it. Send all the files to Tom. He's gonna mix it. Record video on your own. Send it to him. He'll edit it all together. Like, we would do a lot of covers, like, split screen, because we didn't even have the time to, like, meet up, because at the time, you know, I'm still in college, Tom's still in college.
Oh, wow. Like, I didn't realize that. I mean, I would never know seeing your videos that it was logistically that complicated.
I mean, some of our better, like, our better videos, obviously, we meet up for it, but sometimes, like, we just want to crank something out, you know, rapid fire, because when a song just drops, that's when people are searching about it. So you want to have something up that's not only good, but, you know, get the quicker you can get out something good, the better. So we did that a lot. But there was also, like, a lot of just, like, raw grind. Like, every one of us in the band, back when there was four of us, we like, I had everyone make, like, another Facebook account, like a personal Facebook account, and we would literally go on the Facebook pages of bands that we loved, and we would literally kind of just add people, like, just add their fans, start conversations with them, ask them if they want to check out our music. Like, it was literally like a grind. Like, I remember being in college still, in the back of a classroom on my laptop, low-key trying to take notes, but not really. But mainly I'm just on Facebook basically being like, yo, like,
be my mixtape. Priorities.
Yeah, basically. So there was a lot of that, you know, between the four of us doing it. Like, we made sure we allocated time every single day to doing that. And, you know, some of our biggest fans who stick with us to this day have, you know, that's how they found us, mm-hmm. from randomly being promoted to on Facebook. And then eventually we extrapolated that idea to doing it, like, in person. Like, thankfully, we live in New York City, you know, one of the biggest, like, basically any major tour is going to stop here. And we have so many venues and so many shows going on every day. So we would make sure that, you know, whenever possible, someone would show face at a show, promote to people on the lines, like, really just meet people face to face. I think the mindset I've always tried to maintain when building our following is, like, literally every person counts, mm-hmm. and always aim for, like, quality more than quantity. So I think that's a testament to, like, the reason why, you know, obviously we're not a huge band by any means, and we're definitely not even close to the point where we could really call this, like, a full-time career, mm-hmm. but that said, you know, we're still able to manage to have people out there from, you know, different states, some in different countries even, who love us enough to get a tattoo of our lyrics or whatever the case may be. And I think it's because we really put that level of dedication into not just building relationships with our fans, but actually, like, maintaining it. And, you know, like, we have a Facebook group called In Loving Family, where a lot of our biggest supporters, you know, have met each other. Like, again, it's beautiful to see, like, people from different states, different cities, you know, connecting like that. And they have group chats on their own. Like, this is not even me, like, wow, telling them to do that. Like, they make group chats. They invite us in them. Like, that's what I'm talking about.
When it comes to community.
Exactly. Yeah. I think any type of brand, you know, let alone music, like, any type of brand has to establish some sense of community. So I think the fact that we were able to do that without even necessarily trying, we were just being ourselves and putting ourselves out there until some sense of a community started taking shape on its own, I think that's a good sign. And
yeah. So for anybody listening, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to start up, whether it's a business, whether you're an artist, a musician, whatever you are, connect.
Absolutely.
Connect with people.
There's a concept, I forget which entrepreneur started this, but it's like the idea of, like, 1,000 true fans, mm-hmm. where it's like, instead of aiming to, like, throw your product or whatever at, like, 1,000,000 people, try to instead focus on, like, nurturing and honing in on 1,000 true fans, meaning, like, a true fan meaning someone who loves you enough that whenever you drop something or release something, they're most likely going to buy it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as far as, like, how to turn your brand into something that could hopefully be a sustainable business for you, I think that's definitely the model to take.
Cool. How did you come up with the name In Loving Memory?
So I was like, I remember this pretty vividly. I was like 16 or something, like, just doing homework at my desk in my room. And I had, like, the news on in the background on the TV. And I forget who had passed away, but obviously the reporter is talking about, like, in loving memory of, you know, this person. And then I kind of just stopped writing. I'm like, loving memory. Then I kind of just started thinking about that phrase, and I was just like, why is that, like, sticking to me? Mm-hmm. And because, like, you know, usually you do hear that phrase in reference to someone who has passed. Like, it kind of has not a negative connotation, but a kind of, like,
a little dark, I guess.
A little dark, yes. A little dark connotation to it. I guess I kind of just wanted to put a positive spin on it, where it's like, you know, you acknowledge and you embrace your past, but, you know, you use it to propel you into the future. So always just pushing and thinking forward
is how I think about it. Music often reflects that. An appreciation rather than, you know, some kind of mourning or something.
Right. I'm glad you think so, because that's definitely what I'm trying to put out there.
Yeah, you do a good job communicating that. What are, like, some other challenges that you face other than, you know, all the stuff we've talked about, like being a person of color and your background and etc.? I know you lost a couple of bandmates at some point.
True, we can talk about that. Yeah, so I mean, being in a band is like, especially when we were four people, it's literally like having three boyfriends at the same time. Like the level of intimacy that needs to exist between all members of a band, because at the end of the day, you're not just a band, you're business partners, you're best friends, you know, you're everything. So there really can't be any secrets from each other. And you really learn to get an understanding of everyone's individual strengths and weaknesses, not just as musicians, but like as human beings. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I've learned a lot just from relationships in general, and just being an open-minded and communicative person from being in a band. Because, you know, when those intense conversations come about, that's when you really see, like, you know, who's trying to be in this band long term and who isn't. Because, you know, as a band is growing and getting more serious, you know, more sacrifices come with that, sometimes to the point where, you know, you may have to eventually quit your job and go full time with it. And if not everyone in the band is willing to take that leap, it can create some distance between members. Or, you know, sometimes it's not even that. Sometimes, you know, the creative direction of the band just goes in a certain way where members feel unfulfilled being in it. So a multitude of things can happen that can, you know, cause band members to separate. But the thing I'm glad about is that even though we had two members leave in 2018, like it wasn't on bad terms.
Okay.
So like we're still all cool with them now. Obviously, you know, me and Tom are carrying the torch ourselves, but it really teaches us what to look for in, you know, if we were to open up in Loving Memory to get another full-time member, because that's a question we struggle to figure out. And we're still learning to navigate this now, is like, how are we really going to execute being a band as a two-piece? So the creatively and business-wise, it feels fine, because even when it was four people, it was Tom and myself, you know, writing most of the music and handling most of the business decisions. However, the main hurdle we had to figure out when our other two members left is, okay, how are we going to play shows? Because that's two guitar players that we don't have anymore. And so we've figured out a good system where, like, basically not to get too much into the technical audio side of it, but basically, like, we record all the music ourselves, and we are able to basically take the guitar tracks and route them through amps when we play live. So it's not just like you're playing the guitar tracks over the PA. It's as if you're taking the raw guitar tone and applying the amp's sound to it. So basically it's going to sound as if it's being played by a human.
Okay.
Like, it's basically the same guitar track that you would hear on our recordings. So that at least settles the sound aspect. Like, we're able to have bass and guitar covered while Tom is playing drums and I'm doing vocals. And then we have, you know, whatever electronics, you know, whatever samples playing on our backtrack. But then there also comes, like, the showmanship aspect. We're two guys on stage now. How do we make it lively and entertaining enough that people don't feel like there's something missing, quote-unquote, from our performance? So obviously, you know, that's forced me to step up as a front man. Like, I physically have more room on stage now because, you know, I don't have two other guitarists to share it with. So, you know, if you come see us live, you'll definitely see me jumping around a whole lot. Like, I definitely gotta, you know, I have to deliver that energy.
Okay.
And Tom, as a drummer, you know, now that he has less musicians in front of him, you know, he's more visible to the audience. So he's had to elevate his stage presence and his charisma as a performer as well. So if anything, like, losing the two members, it's still challenging because now we're just getting into the groove of playing shows again, which so far so good. We're loving how, you know, how we're sounding and looking now as a band, more so than we ever have. But we're constantly trying to, like, improve on that and really just elevate both our abilities as performers to the next level.
Yeah. And what about kind of behind the scenes? What does your writing process look like? Where do your lyrics come from? What's your inspiration?
Yeah, so as far as, like, recording our music, it's literally just me and Tom chilling in his basement in his home studio setup making music. Like, it feels really innocent and almost carefree in that sense. Like, we're just two dudes making music, which I love because it's a lot smoother of a creative process, to the point where, you know, like, even when me and Tom aren't together, he can just FaceTime me and we can talk about the mixes. Or, like, honestly, we've gotten pretty efficient. Like, when time came to record the EP, you know, when you're working on six songs at a time and you're slowly tweaking each mix to get it, you know, perfect. I literally make like a Google Doc and I like list by each song. And whenever Tom sends like a new mix of the songs to me, I basically like make a list in Google Docs like, okay, at 2:22, make the guitar part here a little quieter or pan this more to the right, like little things like that. So we've really dialed in a system where like just the communication between the two of us is really like that fluid. And as far as like lyrics go, I mean, I don't know, like the thing I love about like poppier music and like hip hop music is like I can be a lot more raw and honest, and I don't necessarily have to dress up my message in a lot of like vague metaphors, like okay. When I was younger, that was something I found really beautiful in rock music. But I guess just the way I'm growing up now and the way I want to package what I have to say, I feel like this is the music that allows me to deliver that raw authenticity. Mm-hmm. So sometimes if I have an instrumental that I wrote and I'm thinking, I literally just start from like, okay, what does this make me think about? And whether it's something like a heartbreak song or whether it's something about like, you know, like wanting to, whether it's something about feeling, you know, overwhelmed with your mental health. Like there's literally a song on our record called Overwhelmed that literally just started as me just playing random chords on an acoustic. And then in an hour, I had basically the verse and the chorus, and I send it to Tom, and he's just like, okay, we're gonna take this acoustic song, we're gonna put a beat to it, we're gonna see where it goes, and then yeah. It just builds from there.
There's a track on Spotify for the listeners in which you describe the whole process of like going into, I think it was a Guitar Center, or maybe it was a Sam Ash.
Oh,
and then you were like fiddling around with.
Yeah, that was an older song of ours on our previous EP, Introspective. That was when we like really honed in on like the post-hardcore, like metalcore kind of sound. Yeah, that was a funny one. I was like 16 in Guitar Center, mm-hmm. trying out like a 7-string guitar for the first time. So basically, like
yeah, that was the one.
They have like lower tuned strings, and when you're in metal, like the lower tuning stuff just sounds a lot heavier and just sounds a lot more brutal. So when I discovered bands that played in low tunings like that, I was like, oh my god, I want to try this. So I'm trying a 7-string guitar for the first time, and the guitar riff that started that song basically just ended up, you know, coming from me jamming out in that store. I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Like sometimes like musical ideas can really just hit you literally out of nowhere. Like I've been in class, I've been at work, and literally like melodies will just come to me. In fact, and this is so funny, at the job I recently was holding down, I've been writing a lot with Tom, even when we finished recording the record, because we've just been so inspired lately by the new writing synergy that we have as the two of us, that we've actually just been writing nonstop since, which is new for us. We usually take a break when we finish writing for a release.
Okay.
But there have been plenty of times when I was at work and I'm just like, okay, this is a dope melody, I don't want to forget it. I would literally like try to come to a stopping point in my work and then just take like quick a step outside and like voice memo it, like hum like a melody to myself so I don't forget, and then I just go back to work. Like sometimes it's literally that, you know.
Well, that's what it takes when you're double dutching.
Totally, yeah.
What are some of the hopes and plans you have for the future of In Loving Memory?
So for the foreseeable future, I think what I want, at least for 2020, I mean, hey, it's the new year. So my main goal for 2020 is, you know, now that we've solved our identity crisis of like, okay, what's our sound going to be? What's our image going to be? How are we going to, you know, how do we present our brand to the world? Now that we've sort of figured that all out, I basically want to kind of reestablish ourselves like on a local level, because, you know, we have done some small tours in the past, but now that I'm confident that with the brand that we have now, there's so many more people that we can impact, you know, literally right outside this building, you know what I mean?
Right,
like
as we're
chilling here in Manhattan, like I really want to, basically, I want to be NYC's hometown hero. I'm not even going to phrase it any other way. I want people to be like, yo, that's going to be the next kid to make it out of New York. That's going to be him. So for sure, I would definitely love to play bigger shows locally. We ended 2019 with our EP release show, which was in Brooklyn at a venue called Gold Sounds, and we managed to sell that out. So hopefully this year we can execute some bigger headliners and, you know, play some slightly smaller shows to build up to that. But the main thing I want to, like, main thing I want to explore this year is playing shows with different audiences and different types of artists that we never could really before, which we've already been able to do recently. Like, last month we played a show with Aaron Carter, which, like, he was like a huge pop star back in the 2000s. And that was cool because that's something we never would have been able to do with our old sound. And, like, there are just, like, other things we've been able to do. Like, for example, like, also last month, I did, like, a solo performance at, like, basically, like, straight up, like, a trap hip-hop party, like, a DIY event that me and a couple friends threw in Queens, and I'm just like, this is so cool, like, this is something I never would have been able to do with our old sound, and it's clear that I'm, you know, it's clear that we made the right choice, because now I'm making music that is resonating with, you know, the people that I do want to be reaching.
Because
for me, I've realized, I think what makes me different than a lot of artists is that, you know, a lot of artists, obviously, you know, they envision themselves performing to, like, thousands of people every night, but I've learned to take it a step further and really imagine, like, okay, like, what, you know, not just the number of people, but, like, what, you know, what do those people look like? What are their values? What kind of beliefs do they uphold? What other artists do they listen to? You know, things like that. So really, really honing in on what I want the culture of In Loving Memory to be, and whoever supports us.
What other artists are you listening to?
Ooh, so right now, let's see, who am I into? Lil TJ has been one of my favorite, like, hip-hop artists lately. Like, he's literally, like, an 18-year-old kid or something from the Bronx, and he just dropped a single with Lil Wayne. I was like, what?
Whoa. This is cool.
Yeah, no, he's on his way up for sure.
Great.
So he's dope. I'm super into some boy bands, like, straight up. Like, they're, my favorite one right now is called Pretty Much. They're kind of like a mini One Direction in the sense that, like, Simon Cowell put these five guys together.
Okay.
But they're super dope. They're also cool because they're the only boy band I see, like, these days that actually, like, straight up, like, dances. Like, kind of like how they used to in the 90s. So they kind of have that nostalgic vibe. But they're also super talented. They produce a lot of their own music, too. They write a lot of their own songs, which, you know, you don't really see that from boy bands. So they're super dope. So, yeah.
Cool. So before we close this episode, tell us what other shows you've got coming up.
So right now we only have one show coming up. It's going to be on January 31st, which is a Friday, I believe, going down at the Kingsland in Brooklyn near the G Train. This show is going to be a little more, like, close to our roots in the sense that we're playing with, like, a bunch of, like, metal bands and rappers, like, artists that we're friends with and artists that we used to play shows more so with back in the day when we were heavier. But I wanted to do this show kind of just, like, to test, like, okay, how well can our new music fare with that same crowd? So that's coming up. I'm also planning, I mean, you know what? I might as well spill some tea, because if you've listened this far, you deserve to know the tea. So I'm currently planning what will probably be the next In Loving Memory headliner. I want it to be, like, in the springtime or so, because we, you know, need time to plan it. Basically, I want this to be, like, a charity show. I'm still trying to iron down, like, what venue we can host this at, but I've already picked the charity that I want to, like, basically all the ticket proceeds from this show are going to go to this charity called KIND, K-I-N-D, which is, I believe, stands for Kids in Need of Defense. It's the nation's largest charity that basically works to assist kids who are at the southern border seeking asylum, because a lot of these kids, you know, they're not even there, you know, with their parents. Like, a lot of them just kind of fled from their home countries on their own, and so they have no idea how to handle the legal process and all the costs associated with that. So this organization helps, you know, basically get these kids lawyers so they can safely get into the country. So I reached out to the organization. They're on board. They think it's cool. So basically I just have to iron down the logistics and really, like, you know, package the show together. But that's something I definitely want to do. And hopefully, you know, since it's a good cause, hopefully that's a show that we can execute on a bigger scale, get a ton of people to come out and just, you know, really support something great like that.
Well, look, I love that you're doing that. That's, I mean, it honestly seems really on brand for you guys. I love the stuff that you guys are always talking about releasing. You and Tom seem to have like this beautiful relationship, and I'm really happy to hear that it actually is as beautiful as you portray in Instagram, Twitter, everything. Tom's hilarious and awesome, by the way. Like, I love his online presence.
Yeah.
So shout out to Tom. He's not on this episode. Sorry, Tom.
But... Miss you.
Hi, Tom.
I'm seeing him in 2 days.
For more updates on In Loving Memory and what they're up to, you can follow on Instagram, In Loving Memory NY, as well as at Naveed Stone. And you can follow Tom at In Loving Tom for shows and events. And I'll also put these handles in the episode description. Reach out if you have any questions or feedback or concerns, or if you just want to say hey, reach out to either of us, or you can reach me at The Desi Condition on Facebook and Instagram. Like, leave ratings, share. If you're listening on a platform in which you can leave ratings and reviews, please consider doing so. And I will talk to you next time.
Cool. And once again, thank you so much for having me, because honestly, like, this is the type of content, this is the type of platform that, like, I wish was a thing when I was a kid, you know?
So, oh, we're rising up as people of color.
That's a fact.
It's, yeah. That's I'm seeing, like, more podcasts that are like this, more, like, you know, music and, like, artists, like, it's coming.
Absolutely. This is a new decade, and yeah. I really think that, like, this is the decade, like, just on a quick final note, I feel like we're the last minority that's been allowed to be cool in America, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
Because, like, basically, like... Yeah. Because some people tell me, like, what are you talking about? Like, Asian people are, like, so cool here. Like America loves Asian culture. I'm like, sure, but, like the way I'd phrase it is, like, it's going to be a little while longer before we see, like, the brown people version of, like, crazy rich Asians in theaters. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know what? 2020, we're coming for you.
We're coming. It's 2020. It's a new year. Bye, everyone.